Management and strategy consultants are paid to help solve business problems. Over the past 30 years, the Context Network has assembled top talent and expertise to help agribusinesses navigate a constantly changing environment.
It's very rare that we only bring one mindset to a project or one expert to a project, because the collision of thoughts and ideas is actually where newfound ideas and innovative things are found. You've got to have the diversity of thought in order to generate really meaningful ideas for anybody.
Christian Guffey is a partner at the Context Network. He joins us to share how the firm operates, how they find and keep top talent, what it's like to scale a client services firm in agriculture, and what's changing in the industry today.
Our food security, especially in the Western world, has been outstanding because the incentive system was largely tied to quantity of production. And now we're moving to a system, we certainly value quantity, but we also value sustainable agronomic production practices. We also value the ability to understand where and how our food is produced. We fill in the blank. Okay, well, that incentive system needs to change accordingly then too. And we're still wrestling through that.
Christian Guffey of the Context Network on today's Future of Agriculture podcast. Well, hello, fellow ag nerd. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of The Future of Agriculture. My name is Tim Hamrich, and every week you and I get to hear from the farmers, founders, innovators, investors, the people shaping the future of the ag industry. I'm very pleased that this quarter of The Future of Agriculture podcast is brought to you by our quarterly presenting sponsor, which is Swap Maps. Because when you know more, you grow more. Swap Maps variable rate technology helps you understand the why of field variability and how to better manage it. Understanding soils is the core of a successful fertility program, and Swap Maps allows you to map, measure, and better manage your soils using data that accurately delineates areas with similar fertilizer response characteristics. Turn your data into actionable value with Swap Maps. They're your trusted variable rate provider on millions of acres currently with a 98% retention rate. Swap Maps, they do variable rate right. Learn more at swapmaps.com. Book a consultation or just check out more information. That's swapmaps.com. But you don't have to take just my word for it. Listen to Tyler Kessler talk about how Swap Maps opened his eyes to the potential of variable rate and how it's worked for him as both a farmer and agronomy consultant working in southern Saskatchewan.
I started being introduced into Swap Maps, and that really was the kind of the turning point of where I believed it started to make sense for me. I could see it started making sense for the clients, and it was the base layer of if you're actually dealing with physical properties. You're not dealing with just yield maps, you're not dealing with imagery to try and, you know, market a scalable business. In our case, we've got 99% retention. Anyone that has tried it continues to increase their acres and they want more.
Again, their website is swapmaps.com, where you can learn more. Thank you again to Swap Maps for supporting Ag Innovation and the Future of Agriculture podcast. All right, now back to our featured conversation with Christian Guffey of the Context Network. I wanted to bring Christian on the show to talk about talent and about growing a client services firm. I think both of those are interesting and important topics that I really haven't done a great job of covering here on the show. In client services, which is the business I'm in, so this is kind of selfish with the consulting that I do, all you have to sell is your talent, is your expertise, is your capabilities. So finding ways to recruit, retain, and develop talent is extremely important. It's important to any business, obviously, but especially in a business where your people's abilities is really the only thing you have to offer. Christian had some great perspective on this in today's episode and some interesting insights into the way Context operates. For some quick background here and some context on Context, Christian's a partner at the Context Network and has been with the firm in a variety of roles for 10 years now. He has a wide range of experience in working with clients across the food and agriculture value chain, with notable focus on the upstream crop and animal sectors. He's worked with clients in the development and execution of strategic plans, along with market and competitive intelligence. He also advised companies on corporate financial planning, including capital expenditures, business unit divestitures, and strategic acquisitions. Context clients are many of the largest companies in the agriculture industry, including manufacturers in crop protection, animal health, ag equipment, seeds, processing and handling, and many others. And if that sounds a little bit vague, like, hey, you didn't even mention any specific clients, it's because it's extremely confidential, the type of work he does. He operates at some very high levels on some very confidential conversations. So we do have to generalize a bit in today's episode. But having worked a little bit with context myself in the past, I can tell you it's really impressive the amount of the industry that they're able to cover. Anyway, I'll drop you into the conversation here where Christian's explaining a bit more about what context does, including some more specific examples.
You know, the work that we do, where we really pride ourselves on the ability to go deep, is on items that are pretty pressing in the here and now, on delivering a business, you know, operating or executing against a P&L, or managing through a product launch, or, you know, near-term diligence work on M&A transactions, or, you know, a variety of topics. But I'll give a specific example as to the type of work that we've got ongoing right now, just to make it a little bit more tangible for folks. So, you know, we're working with a provider in the precision ag space on correction services. So as many folks know, growers have widely adopted things like auto steer and some of the other correction services that are now being used all the way through, not just planting, but also certainly spraying, and even now in tillage. And we're working with that provider to better understand specific pricing models, distribution models, and then variances in different correction services, whether those be cell-based, radio tower-based, or satellite-based, and what are the benefits thereof, both to the end grower, but also then to the broader value chain as a whole, and how do you develop that value proposition, price it accordingly, and then participate in the actual delivery of that service and product through to the grower. So that's just one tangible example, but we get to replicate that type of format across everything from upstream inputs all the way down to a finished food, fuel, or fiber product. But we tend to operate our service offering in really three different chunks of services. One is your typical strategy consulting, which is really setting and establishing the longer term vision for a company or a business unit. The second bucket would then be management consulting, which we spend a lot of time in, which is then the execution of that strategy. How do we actually go live that out? What does that look like when boots really hit the ground on selling or delivering a product or service and ultimately rendering that value to the marketplace? And then the third bucket is really a gap fill, what we call insights. So competitive insights, market intelligence, other things that are ultimately required, notably in a strategy or management consulting project, because we have yet to show up to a project where everybody knew everything they needed to know to make the best decision. So we gap fill that information with primary research to go better inform those decisions. So those are the three different areas that we work with, and a couple project examples among, you know, dozens of others, because we'll engage on well over 100 projects a year, and have been doing that now for 30 plus years as an organization.
Yeah. And you all, I mean, have amassed over that 30 year time, an incredible amount of insights, speaking to that third bucket there. You know, before I had any exposure to consulting, one of the questions I had was, all right, you're dealing with a company that has resources, has hundreds or thousands of employees. Why do they need to hire someone from the outside instead of just taking some internal people, put it on there? Is it just for the outside perspective? You know, how do you explain that to someone who hasn't been around consulting before?
So we tend to be pulled in a couple different ways. There are times when our clients occasionally just need additional horsepower. When everybody's running hard and you've got a number of individuals that say, hey, we've got to tackle an issue that came up, and you know, we got a bit of a fire drill that we need to run, and they already have full-time jobs. Hey, we just need additional horsepower. So let's call in some additional resources and help tackle some things. And then there's this thought leadership component, where the question is less around, hey, I need more bodies and minds and hands and feet, but I need to validate or pressure test an idea or a hypothesis that our team has arrived at, and just ensure we're not missing anything. How do we look around the corner or find our blind spots. I mean, this is stuff that we as individuals are well served in doing on a daily basis too, right? We all have friends that will hold us accountable. Many folks will engage in, you know, services, whether that be, you know, therapy or otherwise, that you say, hey, let's talk this through and understand it. Or similarly, you hire deep expertise. There's a reason a lot of folks outsource their taxes, right? There's a reason a lot of people outsource their plumbing or their electrical needs. Like, hey, you just know this space well, so you come in and help us do it, or outright do it for us. So a couple different staffing models where sometimes we are just additional horsepower, and then other times we're more of that thought leadership to try and help folks identify blind spots or make them aware of things that they might not otherwise necessarily be privy to. And, you know, the last item is that we will go out and engage in that primary research that I mentioned earlier, which is not necessarily context expertise, but it's our ability to go have the conversations with folks that are, you know, the customer base or the dealer base or whatever it may well be of our clients, to have a little bit more of a transparent conversation when it's coming from an independent resource rather than a potentially biased player in that value chain. So engage in a number of different ways. And as you can hear, that all of it ends up being bespoke.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciated the precision ag example earlier. Is there maybe another example you could share to give people a sense of the types of projects you work on?
Sure. So another one that we've got running right now, we are working with an early stage company that's developing some really cool products in the animal health space and the animal nutrition space for that matter, that is in preparation for capital raise. And in this case, we're coming in as additional horsepower because as folks generally know, these early stage companies are resource constrained and everybody's running a million miles an hour on the directives they've already got. So when you think about the telling of the story that the early stage company is in, the build out and validation and pressure testing of all of the pro forma financials, both from a revenue side build out, as well as a cost side reality check on what's it going to take to really get this thing to be a viable commercial entity. We've done a lot of work around the build out of the pro formas and actually then all of the subsequent bottoms up assumption builds required there. And then there's a lot of advisory work between the fence rows on, you know, how do we think about resource allocation within these earlier stage companies where many times things are being bootstrapped or certainly on a pretty finite and tight budget. So that'd be another example that, you know, very different from the crop side. This is on the animal side of things where we're working with a company that's much earlier stage, pre-revenue, and we're as much a part of the team at this point as anybody because we've been in that organization now for several months. So very different engagements, but really under the same banner of solving challenges.
Cool example. Yeah, when I think of context, I always think of like very large mergers and acquisitions type work with big corporate agribusinesses. And it's neat to hear that that also the same expertise can also apply to early stage startup.
Well, and as you well know, the very large wave of consolidation that came through the crop input space in, you know, 16, 17, 18 was one that we were at those tables as well. There were several big acquisitions and subsequent integrations that took place in 2022 and even the early parts of 2023 that we were party to. So the continuum is pretty far and wide in terms of the size and scale of our client base. Some are pre-revenue and some are measured in the multiple billions. But that's kind of the fun of the role. We get to engage across a number of different clients with very different life stages and very different product and service offerings. And I think that's one of the big reasons that our talent pool is one that is willing to engage and stay with context, because the diversity of the project engagement is one that generally suits someone well if they like to bounce around quite a bit.
That actually gets right to what I was going to ask you next, which is about talent. I want to go there here for a few minutes. And certainly, if you're on a dozen or more projects in a year, I assume that's a dozen or more different clients that are all located somewhere else in the country or perhaps the world. And the way that you all are structured, you're very decentralized, distributed, remote teams. And so you have to be very okay with that sort of, like, I don't want to say inconsistency, but changing of teams, changing of locations. I imagine you have to be very fluid and adaptable for this.
We do. And we've been virtual since the start. So context history is a bit interesting in that we've been around now 30 plus years, but the first 10 years was largely under a sole proprietorship with our founder, Trey Thomas. The next 10 years was a very early stage partnership that was entirely dependent on either the partners or an independent contractor base. And then about 10, 11 years ago, we started hiring employees and moving more so to this hybrid model. But throughout that time frame, we've always been very virtual. We've had several office locations and still do that we will use as central hubs for folks to land if need be, and they're generally centered around our client hubs as well. But when the rest of the world had to move to virtual here in 2020, we were already there. And we've always been that way. Most of our folks work from home. They're allowed to live wherever they want globally. We have team members around the world. And that actually gives us the ability to touch and cover our clients in a better way, where we tend to have someone that's pretty close to where we need to be at any given time. So virtual workforce does present challenges, notably through face-to-face and person-to-person engagement at times. We have to create that. So we meet as a team in person in order to help generate and build those relationships and also just have some cross-pollination across the teams. But we also move folks amongst different clients and different teams within context, naturally managing confidentiality as we do that, but really to help ensure folks get a chance to work with different personnel and different types of projects along the way.
Right. And so, I mean, obviously the ability and the passion for solving business problems is going to be foundational to the right person. Also, the desire for this kind of rapid pace, change of pace, I imagine a fair amount of travel. A lot of times you'll hear this trope in ag, which is like, oh, if you want to know anything about food, you should just ask a farmer. And I actually like push back against that a little bit and say, like, if you want to know anything that happens on a farm, absolutely, you should talk to a farmer. But there's a whole lot of food and agriculture that actually happens off farm. So if you want to know about, grain merchandising, you should probably ask a grain merchandiser. If you want to know about soy processing, you should probably ask somebody who's involved in soy processing. To your point, nobody is an expert all the way from, inputs to farm to fork and all the way through. So for you, how important is it that the people that are on your team, since what you have to sell is expertise, are coming in with legacy ag expertise? Because if I remember right, you didn't come from a farm, right?
Yeah, so this is a topic area that I've got quite a bit of passion around, because my background is different from many in this space at this point. And I did not come from an agricultural background, in that when I say that, I didn't grow up on a farm is what I'm talking about. And I will never forget many of the initial conversations that I had actually prior to joining Context. I was with another ag consulting firm for a couple of years, that so often in the meetings that we would have with clients and whatnot, you'd naturally get through introductions, and the age old question would inevitably come forward, which is, where's the family farm? And this wasn't that long ago. I mean, we're talking 12, 13 years ago. And I always felt inadequate in my answer to that question because, I didn't have one. And my thought at the moment was really one of, hey, that seems a little short-sighted on not so much the question, but the reaction that folks would tend to have when the answer was, hey, I didn't grow up on the farm, or what they hear is, you don't have any mud on your boots and you don't know what you're doing. And what I wanted to oftentimes say in reaction to that is, well, hold on a minute. This value chain, to your point, Tim, is massive and has many different sectors. And how many people walk into any other industry and have that type of reaction? Be it real estate, be it banking, be it consumer packaged goods, you name it, right? There is no where's the family farm question for these other industries, because people learn those industries and they ultimately can build a very successful and impactful career set just by learning the industry. And the ag industry as a whole, if you really had a prerequisite for employment based on who's on the farm, you immediately, in the US at least, are relegated to 1% of the workforce. And in an environment where the ag industry is facing a mounting set of challenges, whether it's feeding more people on fewer resources in a more sustainable way. We can fill in the blank on all the things that the ag industry is continuing to push into. And immediately we're going to say we won't touch 99% of the workforce felt like the wrong answer. Now, I say that in that the industry over the last 12, 13 years has really changed, in my view, on that question. That question's still there in a lot of environments, but people's reaction to it is quite different. Where most of the time, folks now, if you walk into especially a multinational, you know, a large client base, a huge majority of the folks that now work there didn't actually grow up on the family farm. And there are pros and cons to that, right? There needs to be the understanding and of what it means to have mud on your boots. But there are individuals like myself that I do now have mud on my boots because I've adopted the industry and we've moved out and bought property and have some livestock. And so I didn't grow up on the farm, but I actually purposefully chose agriculture and have really come to enjoy the space despite not having the prerequisite of the family farm.
Yeah. And you're not saying this, but I'll say it. Like, it's a bit of a lazy proxy to determine whether someone's credible or not, right? It's like, you know, 40 years ago, did you get up and do chores on a farm is not a really good proxy for, like, how can you help me today? I don't think. And I know for you, you have a challenge of keeping top tier talent on your team. What have you found when it comes to problem solving? I don't want to call them gaps, but areas where new employees tend to need some help, because I'm asking as a father, and I look at my kids and I'm like, man, I feel like I had to solve a whole lot more problems in my young life than they're having to solve. And that's my fault as a father. But like, what's that going to do to them when they, you know, when they get out in the work world?
That's a great question. So also as a father, we've got 5 young kids running around our place out here. And this is a constant question for us as we think about what is it that you ultimately need to teach and instill into your children or into your employees or whatever it may well be. The thing that we value the most is actually less around specific knowledge and more around your ability and willingness to go learn new things, to go challenge yourself, to work hard, to show up on time, to be communicative. Those are the items that actually serve folks well in a world that's changing faster than we can educate folks against it. So we've all heard this kind of quip, which is you can train someone in an item or you can train them how to think. And in a world where 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, which my young kids will be in the thick of their career at that point, their roles may well not exist today, but being willing to learn, self-taught, highly communicative, showing up on time, working hard, those things will still be core competencies for any employee. And those are the things we value more so than what's the specific hard knowledge that you're bringing in, especially as a more junior member of our team. I was always frustrated when I was coming out of my undergrad that the prerequisites for a lot of these roles were 3 to 5 years of experience. Like, well, where did everybody get the 3 to 5 years of experience? Because you have to start somewhere. And we really do want to value folks that bring those, some of those intangibles that I won't say you can't teach them, but it's a lot harder to teach those intangibles than it is to teach them an industry or a client or, you know, a process by which we're going to solve a problem. Those things are actually readily teachable.
Yeah. And you know, that question was more specifically geared towards the skill set. But what about the culture as far as what have you learned about remote work? I think a lot of companies are wrestling with this now. Like, hey, we went remote and I don't know that it worked so well. What kind of have you learned about that, both from being an employee, but also having employees that may be less experienced with it than you are?
Yeah, the hybrid model is one that we don't necessarily have to build ourselves, because so often we're traveling on site to clients where even though context doesn't have the physical office locations in most of these cities, when we're traveling to a client, we're inherently face to face. So we do really value the face to face time versus just virtual, which is why we have our annual meeting that's in person every year. Actually for this year in 2024, one of the things that we're rolling out are what we call office hours, where we are going to aggregate and bring our team, our employee-based team together at least twice a year in person for 2 different weeks to just work together in the same environment and be able to peek your head over the monitor and say, hey, have you wrestled with this challenge before? Or how have you guys handled this in the past? And that doesn't happen in a virtual environment. And you know, one of the other things that we've seen in these virtual meetings, I had a client point this out to me a couple of weeks ago, is that it's so much more natural when you're in person to develop relationship with one another rather than just when you're on a virtual call, the pleasantries at the front end are very minimal. How was your weekend? How did this go for you? How are the kids? It doesn't happen like it does in person where you just naturally sit down and have kind of a conversation before you get into the thick of the meeting. And we've had to build into relationship building within our team members so that when you do show up and you're working pretty late at night on a really hard project and you're tired and things might not be going all that well, like relationship matters. You're going to have to build into folks' willingness to work with one another. So the virtual workplace leaves some things to be desired for as much wonder as it brings on, you know, live wherever you want, a lot of flexibility on your work schedule. You got to make sure you don't have these other pitfalls on the backside of that as well.
Right. Well, you talked about, you know, 1% of the population being involved in agriculture. So it would be silly for context to say like only the people who grew up on a farm could work for us because you automatically get rid of 99%. But similarly, that the type of person who's going to be right and qualified and capable for this work is also got to be a pretty small percent of the population would be my guess. How do you make sure within that you still attract sort of diversity of thought? How do you think about that? And how do you make sure that that happens so that we don't end up in these patterns of like, you know, what got us here won't get us there. And we don't quite know how to think any differently.
Yeah. So we recruit, if you look just at least on the employee side of things, we recruit from a number of different places in different folks' careers. We've got everybody from fresh out of undergrad or fresh out of grad school through to 10, 15 plus years established in a career. So we've got 5 different employee-based roles from more junior to more senior. And we've got folks that we purposely hire from a number of different either sectors or functional areas within the workplace. So, you know, a lot of the team members that we bring have some semblance of experience in agriculture prior to joining Context, unless you're joining as a business analyst in particular. So the diversity of thought is certainly one that is valued. And the other piece that just naturally comes with that is that we have folks stationed all over the country and then all over the world. Even in the same vein, say, let's just call it crop production as a whole, Brazil thinks about and handles crop production different than the US, which is then different than Western Europe, which is different than Eastern Europe. And we've got personnel that touch every one of those regions. So even within the same component, just by having regional diversity, you get the inherent view shift that should come with that. And then, you know, on the independent contractor side or the expert network that we bring, it's very rare that we only bring one mindset to a project or one expert to a project. We almost always put 2 or 3 or 4, even if it's on the same topic, because the collision of thoughts and ideas is actually where newfound ideas and innovative things are found. One individual as a standalone is really not going to be representative of a significant value add. And it's why we always, as Context, show up as a team. It's never an I, it's always a we. You've got to have the diversity of thought in order to generate really meaningful ideas for anybody.
Yes. Say more about that. Specifically, how do you foster an environment for innovative thought and for creativity? Because I know you all, you have to be very data driven by the nature of what you do, but that doesn't mean you throw creativity out, right? I think that's got to be just as much a part of it. So how do you elicit that in your people?
Yeah, we actually really purposely bring a strong mix of quantitative and qualitative to our projects. You know, hard data is a invaluable resource for proving out notably historical known points of movement or use or pricing or whatever it may well be. But it isn't always a perfect view of what's going to happen into the future. You know, trends don't always necessarily continue on into perpetuity. And there is then a need for evaluation and subsequent qualitative expertise that's layered on top of that to help interpret what is the data telling us, and then what are we still seeing as either feedback or input from those that we're trying to serve, whether, again, that's distribution chains, supply chains, customers, doesn't matter. So we really do bring both. I think if you've just got one or the other, you're at risk for missing the whole picture. So as we engage that insights portion of our work that was mentioned earlier, most of the insights that we deliver are actually qualitative in nature. If we're going to go out and conduct, say, interviews, whether that be with growers or feed mills or ag retailers or fill in the blank, we're not going to go out and conduct a statistically significant number of those in the 300-400. We may go conduct a subset of that, that's 30, 40, 50, which is very much directionally accurate to qualitative insights around unmet customer needs or challenge areas in the value chains, things that aren't always data driven, but can ultimately be paired with known and hard data points in order to really get a better view of the totality of what's taking place.
Well, I, you know, as someone who's also trying to grow a client services firm, I can just continue to ask you question after question after question about that. But maybe a good one just to try to summarize some of it is, since I was working with you all to today, you've become a partner. So sometime in the last 5 years or so, you've become a partner. How has your perspective changed on the work and the business? You were already someone who took a lot of ownership in your job and in your company before that. So I know that mentality was always there, but you know, how has your perspective changed as you've looked at this from someone who's really tasked with the future direction of the firm?
The piece that I think is critical to the work that we do, and that was something that was instilled into me quite early within context, is the removal of the word I and really transitioning that to the we, in that we always show up as a team. And that team will change and ebb and flow and be bespoke to the specific needs of that project or that client. But we're going to show up well as a team that delivers around the specific needs of that project. We can't just walk in with an individual with a boilerplate off-the-shelf answer, because the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again. And if we're just going to walk in with the same solution set or idea or feedback, well, you're really not providing value in the long term. You might in the first meeting, you might even still provide some value in the second meeting, but certainly by the third, people are tired of hearing the same thing. And frankly, the world's moving in a fast enough way that by the third meeting, the stuff you may have talked about at the first isn't quite as relevant anymore. So we're walking in with a team, and that team is constantly moving and ebbing and flowing. And one that we are in constant evaluation of internally of, is this the right team? And can we flex around new folks within our network and other folks that are transitioning out? Same within our employee ranks, that as folks are taking jobs, hopefully in industry and with clients, that we're bringing in new talent that continues to elevate the bar, right? You always hire in or recruit in above where you were prior. And over time, you naturally then have the benefits thereof.
Well, as you get this vantage point across dozens and dozens of leaders in agribusiness, I'm going to ask you to kind of aggregate what you're hearing out there a little bit for us. What do you see as kind of the big challenges facing our industry in the coming years, and challenges or opportunities? You can take it either way, I suppose, that we should be paying more attention to.
Yeah, the one that comes forward time and time again in discussions is really less around a specific issue and more around an underlying disconnect in notably incentives. We've got an industry that is continually pulled in more and more fragmented directions. We've got consumers that are demanding an increasing array of tastes and preferences and production methods. And there's room for all of those demands on the consumer side. But we're also then met with the realities of a production system that's inherently tied to notably a quantity-based and then subsequently a quality-based metric system around how much can we produce. And there's a huge disconnect of the incentive systems on the front end of the value chain as there is on the back. And I think the primary driver of that disconnect is actually a lack of understanding between the consumer base and then the whole, in many cases, of the ag industry. And I go back to even where I was prior to jumping into the ag industry 12, 13 years ago, which is that my only touch point with food production was the grocery store. That's an inherently bad proxy for understanding everything that it took to get that product to the shelf. And similarly, many of the the companies and folks engaged in the ag industry as a whole had not done a fantastic job of telling their story and explaining what goes into food production and the level of complication that can come about. And I don't just mean on farm. I mean all of the steps, even prior to the farm, of all of, you know, genetics improvements on both crop and animal, the inputs required to actually produce that product, all of the machinery and the level of complexity to actually produce on time and in a variable weather system. All of these things are required to then move through a processing, handling, logistics, transformation, and sale of a good. We as consumers show up to the grocery store and just expect it to be there. And we don't really know what goes into it. And I think that's been an inherent disconnect then to an incentive system that properly moves the value chain as a whole to the demands of what consumers and or regulators or society as a whole are transitioning to. So I think we've got a long way to go on right-sizing how it is we communicate to one another within the value chain and then to the ultimate consumer base, and then aligning the incentives to actually move the industry to the very needs of the marketplace. We haven't done a great job of that historically.
Interesting. Yeah. No, that's a problem I'm very, very interested in as well, very passionate about, especially the kind of the how do we align incentives within the industry?
Yep. There are a number of organizations that have done some really good work at attempting to solve this, but the size and scale of this industry is such that it's inherently difficult to get all of the right folks in the same room and on the same song sheet. And I don't know that you're ever going to get everybody on the exact same wavelength here, but at least the clarity of expectation and incentives is one that needs to be better communicated within the value chain as a whole. And I, you know, one of the things I come back to, especially in the consumer base and why we have such a vocal push to transition in ag production, is that the pace of at which our ability, just from a physical perspective, to communicate with one another, notably via the internet, has vastly outpaced our willingness and ability to effectively communicate. And that's a massive disconnect, where you have an increasing ability to make the communication actually happen, but the ability to do so effectively has not stayed at pace. And the industry is, I think, reeling from that very issue, as are a number of things outside of agriculture. But it's one that I think we have tremendous opportunity for growth to better explain to the totality of the value chain and ultimately our consumer base and regulators what it takes to produce a food product and how fast can we move from a legacy production system to perhaps a production system that takes into account different incentives than produce as much as you can with as little as possible and things like food security. I mean, it's one of the things that we've taken for granted for a long time, is that our food security, especially in the Western world, has been outstanding because the incentive system was largely tied to quantity of production. And now we're moving to a system where we say, hey, we certainly value quantity, but we also value sustainable agronomic production practices. We also value the ability to understand where and how our food is produced. We also value, you know, fill in the blank. Okay, well, that incentive system needs to change accordingly then too. And we're still wrestling through that.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like something we'll be wrestling through for a long, long time, unless some big changes happen, I guess. But all right, last question that I will let you go. We talked so much about talent today, and you know, a lot of my questions come from the vantage point, like I said, of someone in the client services industry. If you could give one piece of advice to someone else trying to grow their own sort of client service business, you know, what would be your top advice?
One of the things that's just proven out to be really valuable for us, and even then for me individually, is showing up as human and developing relationships with individuals. There is no getting around the fact that we all have a blend of our business and personal realities, and showing up and developing meaningful, tangible, longstanding relationships with one another has proven out to be the single best thing that I've had instilled in me over the years, and is one that I would encourage others to do as well. The power of a network is real. It's why it's a part of our name. And I do recommend that folks spend the time and energy to get to know folks on a personal level as much as you can as well. And it will serve you well and pay off dividends well into the future for you.
All right. Well, that is a great place to end. In fact, I think I'm going to do some of that myself this week. I'm off to World Agritech in San Francisco. I'm sure I'll see some of you there. I'm going to be recording quite a bit of content for some upcoming episodes, but most importantly, we'll be able to see some folks in person that I haven't seen for a long time or maybe never met in person. So really looking forward to that relationship building he's talking about there. Anyway, thank you very much to Christian Guffey for being on the show. I've had a lot of respect for the people at Context for a long time and the work that they do. So certainly it was great to share some of the Context story and his perspective on the show. If you're interested in learning more about any of the work they do or their projects, just go to their website, which is contextnet.com. As always, I'll include a link for it in the show notes. Thanks so much to our quarterly presenting sponsor this quarter, which is SwapMaps. Learn more about them at swapmaps.com. And last but never least, thank you for your time and your attention. I do not take it lightly. I'll be back next week with another story of ag innovation.